Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 278, titled Connecting the Dots, Part 2, being recorded on March 4th of the year 2001. And again, as indicated by the title, all of the elements that we're going to be talking about in this program are by way of review. They've been in previous broadcasts, but I'm going over this again for purpose of emphasis, because these elements have not been juxtaposed in quite this order before, and given the rigorous and far-ranging scope of these broadcasts, and due to the fact that many of these elements are unfamiliar to even relatively sophisticated listeners, I thought that doing this broadcast would be in order. We're going to go right back into this complex web of connections, and we are once again going to begin tying in one of the elements of discussion from broadcast in the last several years, the Bertelsmann firm, in all likelihood a Bormann company, and we're going to tie this in with the ELF, French oil giant that figures in the CDU funding scandal, and in all likelihood in the Bormann subsuming of the French economy, and also perhaps in the pressure by Germany on the French to acquiesce in the federalization of Europe, pressure being formalized at a conference sponsored by the Bertelsmann Foundation, the parent company of Bertelsmann. And bear in mind the connections are outlined in the first part of the broadcast. Financial Times of London of Tuesday, February 6th of the year 2001, details one of the operational links between Totalfina ELF, that's the new ELF company after it was bought out by Totalfina, and, surprise, surprise, the Bertelsmann firm. This article is by Dan Bilewski in Brussels. It's headlined, Global GBL Falls for Bertelsmann's Charms. We've accessed this, and for the records, 275 and 276. This reads in part as follows about the GBL, which in turn overlaps the TV company that Bertelsmann recently picked up, the RTL firm, which it now controls. For Group Bruxelles-Lambert, the Belgian holding company controlled by billionaire Albert Frère, swapping its stake in Europe's largest TV group for a share in Bertelsmann reflects a love affair with global companies. Skipping down, GBL, which is jointly controlled with Paul Desmarais, the French-Canadian head of Power Corporation, has often used its Belgian assets to invest in groups such as French oil giant Totalfina ELF, and French utility Suez-Lyonnais des Eaux. So yet another connecting link between many of these, quote, dots, unquote. Now, we've noted that the connection between ELF Aquitaine, the bribes paid through the CDU, and note the CDU funding scandal, in order to acquire the Leuna refinery in the former East Germany. We're now going to cover an interesting bit of history concerning the Leuna refinery, which you're going to hear mispronounced in an excerpt from For the Record program number 193. That's spelled L-E-U-N-A, and the Leuna refinery was IG Farben's largest synthetic oil refinery during the Second World War. It was the most important fuel facility or fuel production facility for Nazi Germany in World War II. And bear in mind that as we looked at in miscellaneous archive show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika from May 23rd of 1980, they acquired that technology as part of a complex cartel agreement with Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Standard IG Agreement of 1929. We're going to turn now to one of the best books about I.G. Farben. It's titled The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, authored by Joseph Borken, published in hardcover by the Free Press, a division of Macmillan, copyright 1978, ISBN 0-02-904630-0. And of the Leuna refinery and its destruction in May of 1944, this being called the Battle of Leuna, we read as follows. May 12, 1944 was a fateful day for Germany and for IG. On that day, the United States 8th Air Force sent 935 bombers over Germany to attack its synthetic oil industry. 200 bombers concentrated on IG's Leuna plant alone. This attack marked the beginning of what the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey called the Battle of Leuna, classifying it as one of the major battles of the war, unquote, and skipping down, of the report to Hitler of an IG Farben official named Kroc. He told Hitler that Germany's position was hopeless if the enemy air raids on the synthetic oil plants continued. To support his grim forecast, he presented Hitler with an impressive array of facts and figures, skipping down. The only thing to do was to try to put the plants back in operation as quickly as possible, and then protect them with a heavy defensive air cover. Speyer gave the restoration project the highest priority for men and materiel. 350,000 workers were assigned to the task of restoring German oil production. At Leuna, the effort succeeded in bringing the facilities back to partial operation within 10 days, but on May 28th, the 8th Air Force resumed the Battle of Leuna. The result was another crippling blow, which reduced German fuel production by half. By the way, the Speyer referred to there is German Armaments Minister Albert Speyer. Continuing. And skipping down, the course of the Battle of Leuna became the gauge for the state of German oil production. By early July, the resourceful IG technicians were able to restore Leuna to 75% operating capacity. However, the 8th Air Force returned again on July 7th, again bombing the plant to a halt. 2 days later, the plant started operating again and by July 19th had reached 53% of capacity. And so the cycle of bombings and reconstruction continued. But the total effect on German fuel production was nothing less than catastrophic. Kroc concluded that the only way fuel installations could be rebuilt after each raid was to cannibalize other installations. Under this plan to prevent the total cessation of oil production, Germany's productive capacity diminished with each recuperation. By September, oil production had dropped to 15%, a condition from which Germany was never to recover. And that again from the Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben about the history of the Leuna refinery in World War II. Now we're going to reprise a section of For the Record program number 193. This in turn is an excerpt of a New York Times article about the role of the Leuna refinery in the CDU funding scandal. And we're going to hear a couple of interesting names, bearing in mind the dizzying connection that the many connections between the dots that we have already covered. This again from For the Record program number 193.
Bernard Gorny, G-O-R-N-Y, Mr. Guillon's lawyer, declined to comment. On the same day that Nobel PAC received the money in 1992, it wired 220 million francs, or $33.8 million, to a company registered in Liechtenstein called Standby Establishment, and the remaining $5.2 million to the Swiss account of a company called Showfast Limited. Swiss prosecutors say both companies appeared to be controlled by Mr. Lettier and Mr. Holzer, who have not denied receiving the sums. The money was later moved, at least in part, to Liechtenstein foundations. Paul Perraudin, a Geneva prosecutor, has told Le Monde that one foundation, Delta International, is believed to be a front for Mr. Holzer's activities. Another, Foundation Thais, T-H-A-I-S, is thought to be a front for Mr. Lettier. Some of these accounts were frozen in January. Swiss and French prosecutors believe that Mr. Guelfi received more than $4 million for his services. Those included a second use of this company in 1993 with a payment of over $20 million by Thiessen in connection with its partnership with ELF in certain projects at Leuna. Mr. Guelfi justified the payment, bringing total commissions paid to about $60 million by producing false, quote, feasibility studies, unquote. At the groundbreaking ceremony for the new Leuna refinery in 1994, Mr. Kohl called it, quote, the most important Franco-German industrial project since World War II, unquote. He did not explain why. So again, note this dizzying tangle of corporate fronts. Note also that in addition to being the company that manufactured the tanks in this Saudi Arabian tank deal that is one of the sources of these mysterious monies, note also that Thiessen apparently was involved with certain projects with ELF at the Leuna refinery. So again, the Thiessen Group, not only one of the main elements in German heavy industry, but one of the central tiles, so to speak, in the mosaic of the Bormann organization, figures in both the tank and the ELF refinery deal at Leuna.
That, again, is from For the Record program number 193. Now, bearing in mind the Thiessen involvement with Leuna Refinery, I mispronounced that, and bear in mind also the CDU funding scandal, and that was the focal point of 193, we're going to return once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. Now, of the role of I.G. Farben in the Bormann Organization, Paul Manning writes as follows. The Bormann Organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, It is said to be the largest landowner in South America, and through stock holdings controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. Now, note, too, that the Thiessen Group is one of the principal elements in the Bormann Organization, as we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, resuming now, for the purposes of review, discussion of the Bormann Group and Thiessen, turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, of the post-war fate of the Thiessen Industrial Empire and its connections with the Bormann Group. We read, during the final year of his life in Argentina, dividing his time between the villa in Buenos Aires and the ranches, one in Argentina, the other in Paraguay, Fritz Thiessen completed establishing the control that would assure everlasting family prosperity through Thiessen AG. Elder grandson Count Federico Zichy Thiessen of Buenos Aires was placed on the board of this German steel trust. When the Count votes at board meetings in Dusseldorf 3 or 4 times a year, he votes for the entire Thiessen family of South America and Europe. Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, who has a younger brother, Count Claudio Zichy Thiessen, represents the largest single shareholding group with 25% of the stock in Thiessen AG. The remainder of the stock is diffused into Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt and Buenos Aires, which holds shares for many individuals on both continents, including those representing the Bormann Group. So note the connection between the Bormann Group and Thiessen AG. And of the close connection between Martin Bormann himself and the Thiessen family, we read once again from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by way of review. Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, grandson of old Fritz Thiessen, Claudio Zichy Thiessen, and their families are intimate friends of Bormann. Because of this friendship, Martin Bormann has 3 sanctuaries, his own pompous spread in Argentina, and the Thiessen ranches in Argentina and Paraguay. By the way, pompous is P-A-M-P-A-S. We're going to turn now to an excerpt of For the Record program number 273. This deals with the Bush family and the Union Banking Corporation and the Thiessens. This is from For the Record program number 273, B as in Bush, B as in Bormann. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Sarasota Herald Tribune of Saturday, November 11th of the year 2000. This is an article put together by the Sarasota Herald Tribune staff headlined, Author Links Bush Family to Nazis. And this was accessed from their website, that is to say the Sarasota Herald Tribune website at www.newscoast.com. This reads in part as follows. Now, the main element here is the Union Banking Corporation and the Bush family, and as it develops, the Bush family fortune comes from the post-war liquidation of the Union Bank in 1951. The article reads, again, Sarasota Herald Tribune, 11/11/2000. The president of the Florida Holocaust Museum said Saturday that George W. Bush's grandfather derived a portion of his personal fortune through his affiliation with a Nazi-controlled bank. John Loftus, a former prosecutor in the Justice Department's Nazi War Crimes Unit, said his research found that Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a principal in the Union Banking Corporation in Manhattan in the late 1930s and the 1940s. Now, here's the really important part here. That is by way of review for veteran listeners. Listen to this. Leading Nazi industrialists secretly owned the bank at that time, Loftus said, and were moving money into it through a second bank in Holland, even after the United States declared war on Germany. The bank was liquidated in 1951, Loftus said, and Bush's grandfather and great-grandfather received $1.5 million from the bank as part of that dissolution. Quote, that's where the Bush family fortune came from. It came from the Third Reich, unquote, Loftus said. What we're going to do now is to take a look at an element of the archives. And this talks about who ran the Union Banking Corporation. And again, Bush's great-grandfather, that is George Herbert Walker, whose last name George W. carries as a middle name,
and his grandfather, who was Prescott Bush Sr., respectively, by the way, the grandfather and father of the first President Bush, George the First, as I call him. What we're going to do now is to jump back into the archives to June of 1992, and we're going to listen to an excerpt of one of the supplements from June of 1992 to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, the first installment of which was done on May 23rd of 1980. Now, the article that you're going to hear excerpted here is the cover story of the Village Voices issue of May 5th of 1992. The article was authored by Curtis Lang, L-A-N-G, and is titled, Will Family Scandals Sink George Bush? And by the way, that reference is to George the First, not the current president. And again, this is from June of 1992, a short excerpt from one of the supplements to Uncle Sam and the Swastika.
In 1931, Harriman merged with the British American investment house of Brown Brothers, and Brown Brothers Harriman was born. The U.S. government seized union banking as a front for the Nazis in October 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act, according to a recent article in the Austin Chronicle by David Armstrong. The government found that the bank was controlled by the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart NV of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and that this Dutch bank was in turn controlled by German industrialist Fritz Thyssen and his associates. Spellings, by the way, that bank is Handel en Scheepvaart, it's H-A-N-D-E-L, small E-N, capital S-C-H-E-E-P-V-A-A-R-T.
That again excerpted from an addendum to Uncle Sam and the Swastika from June of 1992, the original broadcast from 52380, and in turn the excerpt that you heard read was from the Village Voices cover story of May 5th of 1992, authored by Curtis Lang, entitled Will Family Scandals Sink George Bush? That again excerpted from For the Record program number 273, and in turn containing an excerpt of Miscellaneous Archive Show M11. Now note the connections between the Bush family fortune, the Union Banking Corporation, and the fact that the Union Banking Corporation was basically a Bush family Thyssen venture. We're now going to draw yet another series of connections between the dots. Bear in mind the Thyssen, Leuna, I.G. Farben-Bormann connection that we looked at in connection with the CDU funding scandal. And again, there are many connections between these dots. We're going to turn now to a book called Global Dreams, subtitled Imperial Corporations and the New World Order, co-authored by Richard J. Barnett, B-A-R-N-E-T, and John Cavanaugh, published in hardcover by Simon & Schuster, copyright 1994. Now, what we're going to look at here is the role of Reinhard Mohn, the head of the Bertelsmann firm, in maneuvering one of his protégés, a man named Dieter Vogel, last name V-O-G-E-L, into the head of the Thyssen Industrial Complex, and the relationship between that and the Bormann Group and the Bush family we've already talked about. Turning now to Global Dreams, we read, Gerda Schotehillen is a sophisticated, worldly man who speaks several European languages. He started in the Bertelsmann Company as a young man, ran the company's printing operation in Spain, and quickly became one of Reinhard Mohn's protégés along with Mark Wössner, the chief executive officer, and Dieter Vogel, now the head of the great Thyssen Industrial Complex. And obviously, if the head of Bertelsmann could maneuver somebody into being head of Thyssen, that places him right in the center of this nexus that we've been speaking about so many times. Now, once again, we're going to return to a book that we've used many times on this program. It's called The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press, and copyright 1994. Now, of the relationship between the Bush family and the aforementioned George Herbert Walker, George W.'s great-grandfather, whose last name he carries as a middle name, we read the following, and this concerns the Bush family connection to the Hamburg America Line, another front that was another company confiscated as being a Nazi front by the Alien Property Custodian in World War II. Lofton and Ahrens write as follows: Walker also set up a deal to take over the North American operations of the Hamburg America Line, a cover for I.G. Farben's Nazi espionage unit in the United States. The shipping line smuggled in German agents, propaganda, and money for bribing American politicians to see things Hitler's way. The holding company was Walker's American Shipping and Commerce, which shared the offices at 39 Broadway with Union Banking. In an elaborate corporate paper trail,
Harriman's stock in American Shipping and Commerce was controlled by yet another holding company, the Harriman 15 Corporation, run out of Walker's office. The directors of this company were Averill Harriman, Herbert Walker, and Prescott Bush, the latter, by the way, the grandfather of George W. What we're going to look at next is the connection between the Hamburg America line, connected obviously to the Bush family, as we've just seen, and something called the Himmlerkreis, or Himmler's Circle of Friends, also known as just the Circle of Friends. Now, this is the group of industrial and financial concerns that finance the day-to-day operations of the SS. And listen to the following, turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, we read, Himmler, for example, had been tapping leading bankers and business leaders for contributions to his SS welfare fund from which he did not personally benefit, oddly enough. The companies contributing comprised a list of important banks and industries, Deutsche Bank, Dresdner Bank, Commerzbank, the Reichstag Bank, the J.H. Stein Bankhaus, Norddeutscher Lloyd, and Hamburg America Shipping Companies. And I would also note that at the August 10th, 1944 meeting in Strasbourg, the Hamburg America line was mentioned as a possible vehicle for the Bormann Group and, in fact, did function in that particular capacity. We've looked at that in past broadcasts. What we're going to look at now, however, is yet another company that was involved with the Himmlerkreis or Himmler's Circle of Friends. The following is excerpted from For the Record program number 194, and you're going to hear the connections between the Bertelsmann firm and the Himmlerkreis or Circle of Friends. The following is a New York Times article from Tuesday, January 18th of the year 2000. This is by Doreen Carvajal, C-A-R-V-A-J-A-L. It's headlined, Commission Disputes That Bertelsmann Was Nazi Foe. A year after Bertelsmann, the German media conglomerate appointed an independent group of scholars to examine its disputed history during the Nazi era, the commission issued a preliminary report yesterday that took issue with corporate lore that the Nazis closed the publishing company because of its political opposition. The four-member commission's tentative conclusion was that Bertelsmann was closed simply because its product was not considered critically, quote, important for the war, unquote, effort. The group also found that one of the early family leaders of the company, Heinrich Mohn, belonged to a circle of, quote, sponsoring members of the SS, unquote, and that the small company rose remarkably to become the dominant publisher of reading material for German soldiers. I would add that is also was also the leading publisher of books for the SS. Continuing. The commission, a mix of German and American scholars, indicated that little research had been done on what they called the, quote, SS sponsors circle, unquote. By the way, that's not accurate. There's a lot of information about the Himmlerkreis, or Himmler Circle of Friends, that's discussed in, among other programs, the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program. I talked about it in For the Record programs 99 and 102. Also talked about it in connection with the Hamburg America line, one of the companies that the Bush family was deeply involved with in For the Record program 186, and also came back to it in number 189. Continuing. But it said that the organization was, speaking of the Himmlerkreis or SS sponsor circle, but it said that the organization was made up of members who took no oath of allegiance to Hitler, were not required to serve on active duty in a unit, and were not subject to the SS's physical and racial standards. The commission said it appeared their primary duty was to contribute money to the SS every month. That, again, from For the Record program number 194. Now, what we're going to look at now concerning the Himmlerkreis, or Himmler's Circle of Friends, which included the Hamburg America line, a Bush family business, and also the Bertelsmann firm, we're going to look at the plans for the Himmlerkreis, or the Circle of Friends, to go underground as well. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, a Dr. Busse of the German Armaments Ministry addressed the August 10, 1944 gathering that was the genesis of the Bormann Group, and he said, as Manning writes, Dr. Busse added that German industrialists must be prepared to finance the continuation of the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground just as had the Maquis in France, and that it did go underground just as predicted, and that the Circle of Friends continued to operate is to be observed in yet another connection between the dots. Now, we're going to return once again to the CDU funding scandal. In For the Record program number 193, we discussed a weapons dealer, an international Wheeler dealer named Karlheinz Schreiber, and his connections to the CDU funding scandal, and also to Bavarian politician Franz Josef Strauss of the CSU, which is the Bavarian wing of the CDU. This is excerpted from For the Record program number 193.
Now, I mentioned Mr. Schreiber's connections to Franz Josef Strauss. Also note the comparison to Licio Gelli and the statement in that article that Schreiber is connected to the political far right. We're going to turn now to the book The Bormann Brotherhood, authored by William Stevenson. This is published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, copyright 1973, and by Bantam, softcover, copyright 1974. The circle of friends here refers to a circle of powerful Third Reich functionaries and industrialists who have helped to finance what I call the Underground Reich. And it is described here as follows. The circle of friends later came into the open in its new form. By 1970, it issued regular bulletins in support of Franz Josef Strauss of the Bavarian Christian Social Union, or CSU. An example from a bulletin issued in Cologne, October 1970, quote, "We have appealed to all who sympathized with the National Democrats, the most prominent of neo-Nazi groups, to vote to strengthen the position of Franz Josef Strauss. He is the coming man. He does not succeed nor replace Adolf Hitler, but he has the leadership qualities. The German Army's officer corps awaits the strong man, Strauss. German youth needs strong and stern leadership. The press must be strictly curbed. We must seize power in one way or another, even if the elections are not in our favor. Germany is at stake."
That from For the Record program number 193 about the post-war operations of the Circle of Friends and their connections and endorsement of Franz Josef Strauss. There are those who would say that the last political sentiment would perhaps echo that of the Bush camp vis-a-vis Florida in the electoral coup of the year 2000. We're going to hear one more connection between the dots. This comes from For the Record program number 194 and concerns a connection between Bertelsmann CEO Mittelhoff and George Bush.
As chief executive, Mr. Mittelhoff has consciously set out to make contacts with influential people and celebrities in the United States. He has flown to Kennebunkport, Maine for lunch with former President George Bush, a Random House author. Well, Random House is the largest English language publisher of books. It was added to Bertelsmann's already formidable participation in the American book market. Bear in mind that the von Holtzbrinck Company also is a major player in the American book market. And between the two of them, they are the largest publisher of English language books. They also are the German corporations and foreign corporations have effective control over American technical publishing. And I've noted in the past and in numerous programs, including For the Record Program 180, that there is strong circumstantial evidence suggesting that the Bush family is a major American component of the Bormann Group and what I call the Underground Reich. So it's interesting that George Bush Sr. has works with Random House and is a Random House author, and that Mr. Mittelhoff was apparently cozying up to George Bush Sr.
That, again, from For the Record program number 194, and we have connected quite a few dots in For the Record program number 278, which is now coming to an end. I have alluded to tapes from Spitfire. You can access the list of and description of the various Spitfire programs on their website at www.spitfirelist.com. There is a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 278 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey is now archiving the For the Record segments on Real Audio. You can access those Real Audio archives on their website at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. That concludes For the Record program number 278 being recorded on March 4th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.